Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RVN at Coombfield Vets, Donna Mace. Thank you, Donna. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks, Amy J. Hi everybody, and thank you for attending my webinar on fluid therapy. I hope to cover as much information as I can in the session and answer any questions that you may have. So obviously, you're all aware that fluid therapy is a common procedure that takes place in practice, and what I hope to do across this webinar is to discuss the distribution and composition of fluids within the body, so just to remind ourselves how the fluids are distributed between the compartments and how they may travel in and out of those compartments. When we should be thinking about providing fluid therapy to our patients and what common routes we have available to do that. And then finally, looking at the types of fluids available to us in practice, the common ones that we may use and when we may use those, and then finishing off with just some basic management of the fluid therapy patient and what things we should be considering. So starting off then with distributions of fluids within the body. So an animal's total body weight is composed of approximately 60% water, the remaining 40% being made up of other matter. The water is distributed throughout tissues within the body, and how that's distributed is throughout the different compartments. So two-thirds of that water is found within the animal's cells, and we refer to that as the intracellular fluid. Therefore, 40% of the animal's body weight is made up of intracellular fluid. The remaining one-third of the body's water is then found outside of the cells, and that's referred to as the extracellular fluid. So again, what that means is 20% of the animal's total body weight is made up of extracellular fluid. Okay, so just to clarify, 40% of the animal's body weight is made up of the intracellular fluid, and 20% of the animal's total body weight is extracellular fluid. That extracellular fluid can then be further divided into two more categories. We have the interstitial fluid. Now, the interstitial fluid is that's found in the spaces between the cells. That makes up 3/4 of the extracellular fluid, and therefore it's 15% of the animal's total body weight. The final quarter of the extracellular fluid is the intravascular fluid, so that's the fluid found within the circulatory system, and that therefore accounts for 5% of the animal's total body weight. So just using these graphics just to clarify. So we have the animal's total body weight. That's divided into your 60% water, 40% other matter, two-thirds of the water being your intracellular fluid, and one-third being your extracellular fluid. Out of that extracellular fluid, which makes up 20% of the animal's total body weight, we have the interstitial fluid, 3/4 of it, and then your final quarter is your intravascular fluid. Okay, so the movement of water from the interstitial fluid compartments to inside the cell and vice versa is caused by osmosis. So osmosis controls how that fluid passes across from the compartments. Osmosis is the movement of water across a semi-permeable membrane, so that just means a membrane that allows certain molecules to pass through, so for example, a cell wall, from a fluid of a low concentration to one with a high concentration. So a fluid with a low concentration just means it has fewer volume of particles to that of a higher concentration. Fluid will continue to pass across that semi-permeable membrane until an equilibrium has been reached, so until there is a balance either side of that membrane. The movement of water across compartment depends on the permeability of the membrane, so how permeable it is to molecules. So is it only allowing smaller molecules through? Are the molecules too large to pass across? And also the concentration of the molecules. So is there a higher concentration one side to the other? They're the factors that will decide how much water will move across from compartment to compartment. So that's how the fluid is distributed within the compartment. So then we want to look a little bit at the composition of body fluids, in particular electrolytes, because that's something that becomes important to us when we're looking at our fluid therapy. So electrolytes are minerals which are found within the body. And there are some key electrolytes that we need to be aware of when thinking about our fluids. So firstly, we have sodium. So the concentration of sodium in the body is regulated mainly by the kidneys. What the kidneys do is control both the distribution of the sodium around the body and also how much of the sodium is excreted from the body. Sodium has a role alongside potassium in nerve and muscle cells, so it is required electrolyte to ensure that there is normal function of both the nerve and the muscle cells mainly. Potassium is another key electrolyte, so 95% of the body's potassium is found within cells, mainly muscle cells. So it's quite hard to monitor the levels because, like I say, they're within the cells rather than the intravascular. Correct concentrations of potassium is really important as it affects cellular function. The kidneys aren't very good at conserving potassium very effectively. So therefore, if we have conditions that result in clinical signs such as polyuria, we're likely to get a further reduction in potassium levels. If the kidneys are excreting more urine, producing more urine, and can't conserve that potassium, then the likelihood is the potassium is being excreted at a greater rate in that urine. Magnesium is another electrolyte to consider. Again, magnesium is found within the cells. It has an important role in cellular processes, so it affects how most cells function. And it's required in particular for normal neuromuscular and cardiac function. Chloride being another electrolyte, the chloride is found both intracellular and extracellular fluids, so it's found inside and outside of the cells. And it plays a role in the metabolic acid base balance, and we'll look at the metabolic acid base balance in a little while. Bicarbonate is an important electrolyte. So when normal metabolism occurs within the body, it causes acids as a byproduct. In particular, the acid that's produced is lactate. Bicarbonate ions help maintain the body's pH at 7.4 by acting as a buffer to those acids. If we get conditions such as severe diarrhea, that results in a loss of bicarbonate ions from the gut, which will then result in the patient being in a state of metabolic acidosis. There's too many acids because the bicarbonate ions are being lost and therefore can't buffer that. Okay, so that's kind of the key electrolytes that we need to be aware of when we're thinking about our fluid therapy. Next, we need to consider when is it an appropriate time to provide fluid therapy to our patients. So if we're thinking about a fluid therapy plan, there are a number of reasons that we might find that we feel that fluid therapy is appropriate. So those sort of reasons, we'll be aware of most of them, but just to remind yourselves, is to replace fluid deficits in cases of dehydration. So if our patient comes to us in a state of dehydration, there is already a deficit that we need to think about replacing in addition to its ongoing maintenance. To correct any acid base or electrolyte imbalances, so if we have reasons to believe that any of those electrolytes that we've discussed are out of balance, then we need to consider the appropriate fluids to replace and correct those. Treatment of hypovolemia, so hypovolemia being a reduced circulating blood volume. So in particular, when we're dealing with hypovolemic patients, our main concern is correcting the tissue perfusion deficit. So what circulating volume is getting out to those tissues. Also then, we need to consider providing maintenance fluid requirements. This might be with our ongoing patients, or it might be when oral fluids are required to be withheld, or that the patient is not voluntarily intaking those fluids. So when considering the fluid therapy patient, it's important to remember that hypoperfusion can be life-threatening and therefore correction is required prior to long-term therapy. So when we're looking at these patients, regardless of the dehydration, what has to be at our utmost priority is the tissue perfusion. If we believe that there is a inadequate tissue perfusion, so a hypoperfusion, that has to become our priority in correcting that before any other concerns. So a clinical exam of the patient can provide us with an indication of the patient's perfusion status. It is relatively subjective, but it gives us an idea as to what their tissue perfusion is. So we want to be looking at the colour of the mucous membranes. Are they the normal healthy pink colour, or are they pale because that perfusion is not getting out to those peripheral areas? Is the capillary refill time normal? So is it less than 2 seconds? If you've got a prolonged capillary refill time, then that's an indicator that there's a hypoperfusion. Pulse strength, again, weakened pulses will indicate that there's a hypoperfusion. And if the heart rate is raised, so if we've got tachycardia, again, that's an indicator of hypoperfusion. So treatment of our hypovolemic patients then. So an animal suffering with hypovolemia is likely to have a severe hypoperfusion also. So if there's reduced total volume, then the likelihood is that volume getting to the peripheral tissues is reduced also. Hypovolemia occurs when we've got a reduced circulating intravascular volume. So that volume within the circulatory system has been reduced. In cases of hypoperfusion, the cells are unable to function normally and are unable to produce energy because the oxygen supply is not getting to those tissues. Now, the body has some responses to this. The body's first response to hypovolemia is vasoconstriction. So it just constricts down all those vessels in the peripheral areas. That vasoconstriction is activated by baroreceptors. Baroreceptors are sensors located within the blood vessels that are sensitive to changes in blood pressure. So those baroreceptors pick up that change, and the result of that is vasoconstriction. It's a quick response, and that response occurs within minutes. The body's second response is then to activate the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone hormonal system. So aldosterone causes the kidneys to retain more sodium, and as a result of that brings water back to and increases the intravascular volume. How quickly that response occurs depends on adequate kidney function. So if we've got poor kidney function, it's going to take longer for that response due to the kidney function. The third response is the release of red blood cells from the bone marrow. That response is stimulated by the release of erythropoietin by the kidneys. So the erythropoietin stimulates those blood cells to be reduced and put back into the blood system. Sorry, released and put back into the blood system. So animals in a state of hypovolemia should be administered shock resuscitation rate fluids. So we give them a higher bolus rate, which we'll look at those rates further on in the presentation. And Hartmann's is often the preferred choice of fluids for resuscitation fluids. It is, however, vital that before we go ahead with this, that we distinguish between our patient being in hypovolemic shock and cardiogenic shock, because the clinical signs can be quite similar. However, aggressive fluid therapy is contraindicated in cardiogenic shock. Cardiogenic shock is more a pump failure rather than a reduction in volume. So if we then give aggressive fluid therapy of large volumes, there is a risk then we'll overload the patient with fluids. The way in which you can tell the difference is by assessing auscultation of the thoracic cavity and x-rays. Okay, so if we're providing fluids to support the hydration status then, so if an animal is in a state of dehydration, this means there's a loss from all of the body compartments. So whereas with hypovolemia, we're concentrating on a reduction in the intravascular volume, dehydrated patients will have lost fluids from all those body compartments. We can do assessments to assess the level of dehydration, and it gives us a rough estimation of the animal's hydration status. Again, it is subjective, so we're looking at clinical signs and making a subjective decision, but it gives us a basis to work from. So clinical assessment of our patients then when trying to decide how dehydrated they are. So if we get a mild reduction in skin turgor, so that's the elasticity of the skin and tacky mucous membranes, we're generally thinking the patient's around about 5% dehydrated, and we'd refer to that as a mild dehydration. just think about when you're assessing the skin turgor, just think about where you are doing that. It's quite common for there to be lots of loose skin around the scruff area, so it's maybe not the best area to test that on. So you want to really go for somewhere like the side of the rib cage, where the nature of that tissue there should spring back quite rapidly. So that's a good place to really kind of assess that skin turgor, rather than an area where there's quite a lot of loose skin anyway. If we get a further reduction in skin turgor, we start to experience tachycardia, dry mucous membranes, and the eyes start to appear sunken. That would indicate that the animal's sort of 6 to 10% dehydrated, and we would consider that a moderate dehydration. Next, if the pulses start to become weak, we have a complete loss of skin turgor, so you tent that skin and there's no return. The eyes are very sunken and dull, and we're now experiencing clinical signs of hypovolemia. That would indicate that the patient is 10 to 12% dehydrated, and we would consider that a severe dehydration. Further on from that, we're looking at sort of 12 to 15% dehydrated, and that's when we see our patients going into collapse, shock, and ultimately death. Additional measurements can also be made to estimate the fluid deficit. So as well as looking at those clinical signs, we can use their body weight. It's a relatively accurate way of assessing fluid deficit. However, it's unlikely that on initial presentation we've got a really recent record of body weight to compare that against. So it may be that your animal's been brought into the practice. We can weigh it that day, but its previous recorded weight may, have been from its last appointment a week or month ago. So we haven't really got a good comparison on that initial presentation. However, an acute loss in body weight, so a short-term rapid loss, is likely to be due to fluid loss rather than nutritional. So it's certainly something that you can use definitely once your patients are hospitalized, because you can weigh them on a daily basis. But if you have been seeing that patient, perhaps the vet's been seeing that patient for a few days prior to it being admitted, then maybe we have got some recent weights that we compare that against. And like I say, a rapid recent weight loss is going to be due to fluids rather than nutrition. We can also use some blood and lab analysis to assess dehydration status. So common tests that we can easily do: increased packed cell volume and total protein is an indicator of dehydration. Increased blood albumin levels will be seen with dehydration. Increased urea and creatinine, and also you'll get an increased urine specific gravity because you've got a higher concentration of particles to fluid within that urine. So there's some quick basic tests. Most practices now will have in-house labs that will be able to do those analyses to give us an idea. So as well as your deficits and your dehydration, we've mentioned looking at acid-base balances and electrolytes. So just to have an overview of what some of those things may be. So the body produces significant levels of carbon dioxide and hydrogen ions. Both those ions are acidic and therefore lower the pH of the body. For most normal cellular functions to occur within the body, the pH level needs to be kept at the correct level, so 7.4. If there's variations out of those levels, then cellular functions don't happen correctly. Normally, carbon dioxide is excreted via the lungs. If we have an excess of carbon dioxide, this will result in respiratory acidosis. So respiratory acidosis can occur if we've got a hypoventilation, so upper airway obstruction, for example. Hydrogen ions are excreted by the kidneys, and an excess in hydrogen ions will result in metabolic acidosis. We'll look at metabolic acidosis a little bit more in a little while, but generally things like diarrhea would result in an increase in loss of those ions. So the body has the bicarbonate buffer system. So the kidneys regenerate and return bicarbonate ions to the circulatory system. What those bicarbonate ions do is bind to the hydrogen ions to produce carbonic acid. Carbonic acid then very quickly dissociates into water, and the carbon dioxide is then excreted by the lungs. So that system is in place just to help maintain that acid-base balance. So just some of those conditions that can occur if that balance is incorrect. So metabolic acidosis. So this occurs if we've had a loss of bicarbonate ions. So that's often the case in cases of severe or prolonged diarrhea. Diarrhea will result in the loss of bicarbonate ions and will then miscalculate that balance. As the pH decreases, the body's bicarbonate levels also decrease due to that buffering system. So therefore, it becomes more acidic. The bicarbonate ions try to bind to them and therefore uses up more of those ions. If the pH continues to decrease, we'll get increased pulmonary ventilation to decrease the carbon dioxide levels in the blood. So the ventilation will kick in to try and lower those carbon dioxide levels. And what that results in is a compensatory respiratory alkalosis. Metabolic acidosis secondary to increased lactate levels in shocked animals is generally corrected as intravenous fluids replace the hypovolemia. So if our metabolic acidosis is because our animal's in a state of shock, just purely by us putting those patients onto intravenous fluids anyway, usually then rebalances out that metabolic acidosis. So it doesn't usually require any further additional treatment. Once the circulating volume is increased by those fluids, tissue perfusion returns to normal and the cells will revert back to aerobic respiration as the oxygen supply increases. So like I said, just the general treatment of the fluid therapy will in time correct that balance. Metabolic alkalosis results when there's been excessive loss of acid. So what that then does is results in excess bicarbonate ions, and commonly that's seen with our vomiting patients. That results in the pH increasing and a compensatory respiratory acidosis occurs because the ventilation becomes depressed. Finally, respiratory acidosis and alkalosis. So respiratory alkalosis occurs when we've got hyperventilation, and our respiratory acidosis occurs when we've got hypoventilation. So the respiratory acidosis with the hyperventilation and the acidosis for hypo. So when looking at our fluid therapy plans then, there's a few questions that we need to ask ourselves. So we've got our patient in front of us and we need to consider what's the best route for this patient. So does the patient require fluid therapy in the first place? So what we want to be assessing is, are they able to intake 50 mils per kilogram per day, which is what we consider the maintenance to be. If they're able to maintain that and they haven't got a deficit in the first place, then it might be that those patients don't require fluid therapy. But if we have doubts that they're able to intake that maintenance, then fluid therapy needs to be an option. Which fluids are most appropriate? So that's going to be dependent on factors. Which route is most appropriate or available to us? What volume of fluid is going to be required by that patient? At what rate and duration should the fluids be administered? And finally, are there any specific requirements for this patient? So are there any specific electrolyte or acid-base imbalances that we need to be thinking about correcting? So just some little points and then we'll look at that in more detail. So the routes that we've got available. So obviously we have the intravenous route, which is suitable in most situations. We have the subcutaneous route, which is generally suitable for cases of mild dehydration or mild disease. Intraosseous route is available. Generally, we'd use that one if intravenous access is limited or unlikely. What types of fluid are we going to use is generally dependent on the condition of the patient and their underlying disease. So what is it we're trying to correct or support? The rate of administration. Ideally, what we want to be looking at is replacing fluid deficits at a similar rate to which they were lost. So if the fluid was lost acutely, then we want to be replacing those fluids rapidly. Volume of fluids. So hypovolemia should be replaced first using shock resuscitation rates. Then we want to be considering our deficits, maintenance, and ongoing losses. Finally, we need to be aware and thinking about when we are going to stop our fluid therapy. So we can think about stopping the resuscitation fluids when we see arterial blood pressure and heart rate returning to normal. Pulse amplitude and duration have come back down to normal or increased to normal. Mucous membranes are pink and the capillary refill time is now less than 2 seconds. Once we're seeing those parameters being achieved, the patient can come off of the resuscitation rates and moved onto your maintenance rate fluids. The maintenance rate fluids can be thought about being stopped once we see electrolyte levels being normal, so that might be through your blood analysis. The patient's now voluntarily taking in oral fluids and food, so if you feel that your patient is voluntarily intaking an adequate amount that's going to maintain that, then we no longer need to provide that as fluid therapy. And when we're seeing urinary and gastrointestinal function return to normal, so if we now got a normal urinary output, have we got normal feces being produced? So looking at some of those areas in a bit more detail then, so routes of administration. So the range of routes that can be considered when providing fluid therapy. So subcutaneous fluid therapy is generally only suitable for patients with early disease or mild dehydration. This method is never suitable for hypovolemic patients as they've already got a poor peripheral perfusion, so that will result in the absorption being too slow. So if there's not an adequate blood supply to those surrounding vessels, they're not going to absorb those fluids. Only isotonic crystalloid solutions are suitable, otherwise what we may see is skin sloughing and possible abscesses occurring if it's not an isotonic solution that's been administered. As a general rule, the volume should be set at around about 10 mils per kilogram, and ideally if we can, administered over several different sites rather than giving that whole bolus in one site, which will further increase the discomfort and also increase the chances of skin sloughing if there's a large bolus in one area. Ideally, what we want to be doing is warming those fluids to body temperature, and that will avoid discomfort and also avoid the chance of vasoconstriction. If the fluids are administered too cool, vasoconstriction is likely to occur, and that will further slow the absorption rate. It's worth being aware as well that if we are administering our fluids by the subcutaneous route, it takes approximately 6 to 8 hours for the fluids to reach the extracellular space, so it's a slower process. Okay, intraosseous fluid therapy, so when we are giving it into the bone, so it's normally the route of choice when intravenous access is hard to establish. So it might be that we've got severely hypovolemic patients and therefore they've got collapsed peripheral veins, so we're struggling to get a catheter intravenously. Also commonly used with your neonates, where again intravenous access is hard, birds and rabbits and your reptiles and those sort of things. There are commercial intraosseous needles available, though if you haven't got those, spinal needles can also be used. If you are going to use a spinal needle, you need to use a relatively large bore one to prevent the lumen being blocked with bone particles. Suitable sites for intraosseous fluid therapy is the trochanteric fossa of the femur, proximal humerus, wing of the ilium, and the tibial crest. When we are preparing our patients for intraosseous fluid therapy, we need to prepare the area in an aseptic manner and also insert the intraosseous needle or spinal needle in an aseptic technique. Once resuscitation fluid has been administered, it's often likely then that venous access becomes possible. So if we have chosen that route because we have collapsed peripheral veins, once we've given the resuscitation fluid, chances are then we're able to get venous access. So often we'll stop the intraosseous route then and replace it by intravenous fluid therapy. However, if we can't do that, the intraosseous route can be used for a few days if required. Okay, so looking at our intravenous fluid therapy then, it's the most common route of fluid therapy that we use in practice. Large volumes of fluid can be administered at a relatively rapid rate using this route. We can use it for long-term therapy, and most fluids available, fluids of choice, can be administered via this route. There are two forms of intravenous fluid therapy. We've got your peripheral fluid therapy, and then we've also got your central venous therapy. So with your peripheral fluid therapy, the most common vein we tend to use in practice is the cephalic vein. However, we can use the lateral saphenous vein, so just on that lateral hind leg. as a second option. It's just worth having a little think before using that saphenous vein as to whether it is appropriate. So for example, if you've got patients that are suffering from sort of uncontrollable diarrhea, there is that risk of contamination of the area and therefore the risk of contamination and infection. So just have a little think about your patient's condition and clinical signs when deciding whether the saphenous vein is appropriate. It's relatively easy to perform and requires minimal equipment. So most nurses and vets are capable of placing intravenous catheters, and there's no specialised or expensive equipment needed. It can be used as a general route for a few days, and particularly if the catheter is placed in an aseptic manner and managed appropriately, then it can be left in place for a few days. Only isotonic solutions should be administered via the peripheral route. With your central venous fluid therapy, it doesn't tend to get used as commonly in practice, but the most common vein to use for central venous fluid therapy is the jugular vein. However, you can use the medial lateral saphenous veins also. Central venous fluid therapy allows for a longer term fluid therapy. And one of the advantages of this is it also has multiple lumens. So you can see from the picture here that there's more than sort of one connector, and that allows for the administration of different fluids through one line. We can also use the central venous route to provide total parenteral nutrition if that's something that we're wanting to perform. And we also have the advantage that it allows for frequent blood samples to be taken from the catheter rather than from having to have repeated venipuncture. So management of the intravenous fluid therapy patient, and I'm just kind of recapping over a couple of main points rather than going over everything in detail, because we're all kind of aware of how we should manage these, but it's just some key areas to make sure that we are familiar with, really. So whenever we're placing intravenous catheters, be it jugular or peripheral, sterile patient preparation should always be performed prior to placement. So we should be doing a proper sterile preparation of the catheter site. Bear in mind that if you're going to digitally palpate for the vein, then we should be doing that prior to the skin preparation. So rather than doing your chlorhexidine spirit swabs and then palpating for the vein, we should be palpating, being aware of the location, and then preparing the skin. Always flush any connectors that you're going to attach with heparinized saline prior to the connection, just to fill that air gap. And when dressing the catheter in place, just ensure that there's no hair contaminating the area, because again, that's then going to break that asepsis of that site. We also need to consider then the methods that we're going to take to prevent the patient from interfering with the catheter site. Nothing more than frustrating than battling to get venous access only for your patient to then pull it out 10 minutes later, which I know we all will have experienced at some point. Just a couple of little images there to think about. So obviously we've got the Elizabethan collar that we're all familiar with a very unhappy looking dog there. They are quite bulky, cumbersome, and equally if you're trying to encourage your patient to voluntarily intake fluids and food, Elizabethan collars aren't always the best thing. I really like these catheter protectors here that the shepherd in this picture is wearing. So they just strap around that site. It allows the patient then to be a bit freer, but it just provides that further protection to that catheter area, particularly if you've got one that likes to have a chew or a lick to try and get that catheter dislodged. We do see, however, some common problems with our intravenous fluid therapy. Even though this is something that takes place in common practice, we do still experience some problems that we'll all be familiar with. So premature occlusion, so when you've got the catheter site blocking, you've got your drip pumps bleeping away at you, can often be due to the location of the placement. So if you've placed that catheter quite high up the limb and you're quite close to the joint, sometimes it's just a case of that animal bending that leg or tucking that leg back is enough to just occlude that catheter. Inadequate flushing of the catheter and just general poor management, so dressings too tight, tape too tight, they're the sort of things that can cause premature occlusion. dislodgement of the catheter. So if the catheter's gone completely out of the leg or is out of the vein and sitting now in the subcutaneous area, just have a little think again about those methods to prevent your patient interference, and just also ensure that we are suitably securing those catheters in the first place. Infection of the catheter site. Generally, with an aseptic placement and appropriate management, we shouldn't generally see infection occurring. So just think about your preparation and management of those catheters. We should be completely removing the dressings when we're checking those catheters, replacing them if they're wet or soiled. Phlebitis, the inflammation of the vein, can present as erythema, so reddening, pain, heat and swelling at that catheter site. So again, another important reason why we should be taking the dressing off rather than just checking around the dressing. Thrombosis can develop secondary to phlebitis, and if that's the case, the catheter should be immediately removed and replaced in a different area. If we do have cases of infection or we're suspicious that infection may be setting in, then again, the catheter should be immediately removed. And if required, what we can do is we can send the tip of the catheter off to be analysed for culture and sensitivity. Just a little comment about your heparinized flush. So we should be routinely flushing our catheters every 4 hours with heparinized saline. However, recent research is showing that 0.9% saline is sufficient. So it's now being suggested that it doesn't have to be heparinized, but we still should be flushing every 4 hours. Okay, so moving on to our types of fluids. So just a couple of definitions to start with, just to make sure that we're all happy with what we're talking about. So when we talk about crystalloids, so crystalloids are generally a saline type fluid. They contain varying amounts of sodium. They contain water, electrolytes and other solutes. Solutes in crystalloid fluids are able to pass through semipermeable membranes and enter all body compartments. So these fluids are able to leave the intravascular system, pass across the wall and into the other body compartments. Colloids are solutions with particles that are permanently suspended within it. The particles in the colloid solutions are unable to pass across the semipermeable membrane, usually because the molecules are too large. So what they do is stay circulating around in the intravascular system. Hypertonic solutions are solutions that contain a higher concentration of impermeable solutes than the solution on the other side of the membrane. Hypotonic solutions have a lower concentration, so less impermeable solutes than the solution on the other side of the membrane. And isotonic solutions have an equal number of solutes either side of that membrane. So a little bit more about crystalloids then. So they are electrolyte solutions that can pass out of the vascular spaces. So if we give them intravenously, they can then pass out of that vascular space. They can be hypotonic, isotonic or hypertonic compared to the extracellular fluid, so have a lower concentration, same concentration or higher concentration as the extracellular fluid. And we can classify our crystalloids as replacement fluids or maintenance fluids. So our replacement fluids then, we generally use ones that have an electrolyte composition which resembles plasma. They can be given in large volumes at a rapid rate. So if you've got your hypovolemic patients, we can give these types of fluids rapidly, or we can give them at a low rate to replenish any fluid deficits. What these fluids do, though, is equilibrate quickly within the interstitial fluid. Therefore, approximately 80 to 85% will have left the intravascular space within an hour of administration. So they quite quickly leave the intravascular fluid and go in to those interstitial fluids. So common replacement fluids that we see in practice then. So we have the normal saline, which is 0.9% sodium chloride. It's an isotonic replacement fluid. It consists of both sodium chloride and water. Has a high sodium content but no potassium. So if we use it long term in our patients, we're likely to develop hypokalemia, so low potassium in the blood. Therefore, supplementation of potassium or changing to maintenance fluids once you have replaced that deficit should be considered. It has no acid-based buffer, so it's not suitable for our patients that have metabolic acidosis because the bicarbonate's not there to buffer that acid. However, we can use it in patients with metabolic alkalosis due to the lower potassium levels and the lack of bicarbonate. And what that, how it does that is by diluting the volume, reducing the absorption of renal bicarbonate so the kidneys don't absorb so much bicarbonate, and bicarbonate secretion in the cortical collecting tubules because of the high chloride levels in the renal tubules. What this solution is useful for is conditions such as hyperkalemia, so if we've got high levels of potassium because we're not then providing further potassium in the fluid, though we generally prefer Hartmann's in these cases because of its bicarbonate content, or hypercalcemia, so if we've got too much calcium in the blood, because high sodium levels, which is found within the solution, prevents calcium being reabsorbed by the kidneys and instead it's excreted in the urine. So it just encourages the body to excrete calcium rather than retain it. Ringer's solution is an isotonic replacement solution. It contains sodium chloride, potassium and calcium. The chloride levels in Ringer's is greater than the chloride levels in plasma. And the high levels of chloride but lack of bicarbonate makes it unsuitable for patients that are suffering with metabolic acidosis. So not unsuitable for your patients that may have diarrhea. However, it is useful in cases of patients with metabolic alkalosis, so your vomiting patients. Hartmann's probably the most commonly used one, or can also be referred to as lactated Ringer's solution. So basically what that is it's a Ringer's solution that's had lactate added. The added lactate provides a source of bicarbonate. So as the liver metabolizes the lactate in the solution, hydrogen is consumed and bicarbonate ions are generated. So that addition of the lactate just provides a source of bicarbonate in this solution. It's therefore the favoured fluid when treating hypovolemic patients. It's suitable for gastroenteritis, gastric dilation volvulus, renal insufficiency, shock and hypercalcemia. So it's useful for a range of conditions and therefore the commonly used one. We also have hypertonic saline, which is 7.2% sodium chloride. This is a hypertonic crystalloid. It's used to create expansion of the plasma volume rapidly. So if we very quickly need to expand that volume, this is the fluid that can be used. And what it does is the fluid is drawn out of the intracellular and interstitial spaces and pulled into the extracellular space due to an osmotic gradient. So that osmotic pressure pulls that fluid across. It has approximately 8% concentration of sodium as plasma, so it has quite a high sodium concentrate, and that's what helps pull that fluid across. It is, however, a short-term effect, as once equilibrium is reached, that fluid then diffuses back out of the intravascular space. So it very quickly pulls the fluid into the intravascular space because of the high sodium concentrate, but once that balance is achieved, it will then go back out of the intravascular space. The solution needs to be given over 5 minutes or bradycardia is often seen. So why would we use it if it's only short term? It gives a very rapid expansion of intravascular volume. So if we have a severe hypervolemia, we need a quick response, we can use that fluid. Also, if we've got large breeds of dogs when we can't give a sufficient volume quickly enough, so obviously we're limited on catheter size, we can't give the volume that animal may need. Because it's only short acting, we often then follow it up with the use of a colloid that can be used longer term. It is, however, due to the high sodium contraindicated in cases of dehydration due to the already reduced interstitial and intracellular volume. So if an animal's dehydrated already, it's already got a reduction in those areas. What we don't want to do is then pull further fluids out of those areas to put into the intravascular system. It's also contraindicated in cases of uncontrolled bleeding, because if we don't know where the bleeding's coming from or we can't get that under control, rapidly increasing that blood volume will further produce hemorrhage. So that's our replacement fluids then. So looking at our maintenance fluids, so once fluid deficits have been replaced, it's recommended that patients are then changed onto a maintenance fluid. These often have lower concentrations of sodium, and therefore are not suitable as volume replacement fluids. Maintenance fluids are often hypotonic solutions, which have been made isotonics by the addition of dextrose. And once administered, the dextrose is rapidly metabolized, which then results in the safe administration of a hypotonic solution. So we generally add the dextrose to make it safe to administer. That's then metabolized quickly and we're left with a hypotonic solution. They're not suitable for the treatment of hypoperfusion as the fluid passes rapidly out of the intravascular space. So we don't want, if we've got hypoperfusion, we want that remaining in the intravascular space. So if these pass out rapidly, they're therefore not suitable. Hypotonic solutions are rarely used. However, if they are, they should be administered at a slow rate as rapid infusion can result in severe dilution of electrolyte levels. And maintenance fluids generally have lower sodium content. Therefore, they're suitable for the management of patients with renal disease and congestive heart failure. One thing that we do need to consider is our potassium supplementation. So maintenance fluids should be supplemented with potassium as the body loses proportionally more potassium. So the body loses potassium at a great rate. The administration of intravenous fluids often results in diuresis. So we often have a larger urinary output and therefore increases the proportion of potassium lost because the potassium is, as we said earlier, the kidneys are unable to regulate it. Other fluids that we see in practice are glucose and water solutions. Generally, we tend to use these as carriers for medications in constant rate infusions. They're not often used for any other purpose now that we have other fluids. So that was our crystalloids. Looking at our colloids then, So give a different purpose. So colloids contain large molecules which are retained within the intravascular space, therefore maintaining the intravascular volume by increasing the osmotic pressure. So these don't pass out of the intravascular spaces, they remain in it. So we're increasing the circulatory volume. So the molecules remain in the bloodstream for a long duration, often several hours, drawing fluid into that intravascular space. So it uses the concentration of the molecules to increase that osmotic pressure, pulling fluid across. Colloids are available as natural colloids or synthetic colloids. So your natural colloids are your albumin, which is a product that occurs naturally in the body. Human serum albumin, which has been used in trials, however, it does show that it carries risks of anaphylactic reactions, so it's not really taking off in veterinary practice particularly. And your plasma products, so your fresh frozen plasma or frozen plasmas, they can be obtained by veterinary blood banks. However, if you're going to use those, you do need large volumes and they are relatively expensive. So more commonly used are the synthetic colloids. So these are available as gelatines, dextrins or hydroxyfuel starches. They're generally cheaper than your natural colloids and are less immunogenic, so they don't produce such an immune response. The duration of the effect is dependent on the molecule size and how large the molecules within that colloid is, though the initial volume expansion depends on how many molecules are present. So the larger number of molecules would give you an initial volume expansion, and then how long that depends stays like it is dependent on the molecule size, because the bigger the molecules are, the less likely they are to pass across the membrane. In dogs and cats, an initial dose of 5 mils per kilogram should be given over 10 to 13 minutes as a recommendation. We need to take care with repeated doses to avoid volume overload. So we need to be sure that the patient requires a further bolus of colloid before going ahead and administering that. All colloids have the potential to cause anaphylactic reactions, so we need to monitor our patients closely following administration of a colloid. And patients should also be monitored for signs of renal function, as human literature suggests that the use of colloids can have an impact on renal function. Okay, so that's our types of fluids. So looking at the fluid requirements. So if a patient is in shock, then shock rates or resuscitation rate fluids should be administered. Generally, a bolus of 10 to 40 mils per kilogram can be given over 15 to 30 minutes, slightly less than that in cats. Following each bolus, we should be reassessing our patient to decide whether further shock boluses should be given. Hartmann's generally is the fluid of choice for our shock resuscitation fluid. It's just showing the equipment that we can use to to monitor and administer. So you've got your infusion pumps there and your burette there as well. Okay, so our endpoint assessments. So we can use endpoint assessments to decide whether we need to give further boluses of shock rate fluids. So an idea that our patient has improved perfusion can be demonstrated by an improved mentation. So if the animal's more alert, more responsive. Decreased heart rate, so if the tachycardia is now coming down to a more normal heart rate. Peripheral pulses are becoming stronger. We've got a normal mucous membrane colour returning. Our normal capillary time of less than 2 seconds is now present. And we've now got an increased urinary production becoming more to the normal 1 to 2 mils per kilogram. If we're seeing those signs, then that's indicating that the perfusion is becoming improved and shock rate is no longer required. Again, they're quite subjective, so a more objective end assessment could include a measurement of your arterial blood pressure, central venous blood pressure if that's something that you have the facilities for, accurately measuring your urine output and measuring your lactate levels. Looking at the maintenance, so if we've finished with our resuscitation shock rate fluids and we're looking at our maintenance, we generally state that animals require 50 mils per kilogram per day maintenance fluid. However, it's a little bit more accurate to allow 60 mils per kilogram per day for your smaller dogs and cats and 40 mils per kilogram per day for your giant breed dogs. So more accurately, we could say that maintenance requirements are 40 to 60 mils per kilogram per day, depending on your size of animal. It's often in practice that we make an estimate of dehydration by saying, oh, we'll put it on 2 times maintenance or 3 times maintenance. However, that is very subjective and therefore we should be monitoring our patients carefully for their clinical signs to ensure that is an adequate rate that we are providing. A more accurate method is to look at all the factors individually. So firstly, we can look at the fluid deficit. So to look at the fluid deficit, we need to assess the clinical signs of the patient to determine a percentage dehydration. Again, it's subjective, but we go back to those clinical signs that we talked about earlier with the skin turgor, the sunken eyes, and we use those clinical signs to decide how percentage dehydrated we believe they are. That percentage dehydration is then times by the animal's body weight in kilograms and times by 10 to give us our fluid deficit in mils. We want to be aiming to replace deficits over 24 to 48 hours, and they should be in addition to the animal's maintenance requirements. So, for example, a 12 kilogram dog who is 8% dehydrated would have an approximate deficit of 960 mils that would need replacing over the 24 to 48 hours. We then need to consider our ongoing losses. So this includes losses from factors such as vomiting, diarrhea, effusion, overly exudating wounds. The losses are estimated and again are therefore subjective. So the idea is we make an estimation of how much fluid is being lost, for example, in one bout of vomiting and how many bouts of vomiting is taking place over 24 hours. So if you had an animal that was estimated to be losing, say, 10 mils of fluid in each bout of vomiting and it had vomited 8 times in 24 hours, then you've got an ongoing loss of 80 mils. So it's just, again, making an estimation of what those ongoing losses could be. When we've calculated what we believe those to be, then our requirement becomes the maintenance, so looking at that 40 to 60 mils per kilogram per day, plus your deficit, so going on your dehydration, plus your ongoing losses, and that gives you your requirement over a 24-hour period. So once we've calculated that total volume, we divide that by 24, which then gives us our patient's hourly rate of fluid that needs to be replaced. It's important we continue to monitor our patients. Remember that fluid therapy is a changing therapy. So we've already made some estimations in the first place. And equally, as our patient's condition alters through the effects of that fluid therapy, so will their requirements. So once the fluid deficits have been replaced, then the fluid requirements and rates should be reassessed accordingly. So is the rate that that animal's now on appropriate? Is there a different type of fluid that would now become more appropriate now that the deficit has been replaced? When we simply use a 2 times maintenance or 3 times maintenance calculation, often the fluid requirements have actually been underestimated and may not allow for changes in the animal's requirements. It's commonplace in veterinary practice now that we use infusion pumps, and therefore calculating the hourly requirement is sufficient because the pump will then do the rest. However, it's useful to understand how to calculate the delivery rate otherwise, so that we are able to do this if pumps aren't available. In order to do that, we need to know the delivery rate of your giving sets. They are variable and usually printed on the packets. However, most standard giving sets will generally deliver 20 drops of per mil of fluid, and pediatric sets 60 drops per mil. However, like I say, do check on the packaging because it is variable. So to calculate then your drops per minute, you would look at your rate in mils per hour. So work out your volume requirement in mils per hour, times that by your giving rate, so be it 20 for your standard or 60 for your pediatric, and that then tells you how many drops per minute you need to administer to your patient. So that's just how you can do it if you don't have your infusion pumps or syringe drivers available. So once we've got our patients set up on the fluids, it's important that we monitor them closely. Signs that indicate that fluid therapy should be stopped as if we're seeing a normal urinary output of 1 to 2 mils per kilogram per hour. That's indicating that the patient is adequately hydrated. A reduction in the urine specific gravity, so we've no longer got that overly concentrated urine. A normal central venous pressure, if that's being monitored. And normal blood serum sodium, potassium chloride and bicarbonate levels. If those have all returned to normal, that is an indicator that fluid therapy is no longer required. Some complications that we may see with our fluid therapy patients. So careful observation monitoring should take place at all times. And the common complications that we'll be looking out for is air embolism. So when you've got air in the system and going into the vascular system. So ensure air is removed from the giving set prior to connection. So it's something that we all are aware of, but it's just reminding ourselves to completely run those fluids through that giving set, ensuring there's no substantial air bubbles present. Don't leave empty fluid bags attached to the giving sets for a period of time either, as that will start to draw air into the drip line. Overhydration is a complication that can be quite serious, so it's one to check for carefully, particularly if we have estimated those requirements in the first place. So the clinical signs that we would see if our patient was overhydrated is we'll start to see edema at the hock and over the dorsal area of the patient. We get an increased body weight after that original deficit has been replaced. So once we replace the deficit, then the body weight should remain at constant. If they continue then to increase the body weight, it is likely that we're overhydrating that patient. If we start to see increased respiratory rates and efforts and nasal discharges, they are all signs that the patient's becoming overhydrated and fluids should be stopped until those clinical signs have returned to normal. So when assessing our fluid therapy patient, it's also useful to compare the volumes of fluid which are entering the patient. So that's the fluid we're providing through fluid therapy, but also any voluntarily intake through water and food, and comparing that against the fluid leaving the patient, so via urine, feces, vomit, etc. What we want to aim to achieve is for the fluid going in to be slightly higher than that going out. So we can't calculate fully for all the losses. So if we aim for the intake to be slightly higher, that will then hopefully remain a balance. The comparison of those figures then provides us with some guide as to whether we need to increase or decrease the volume of fluid that we are administering to our patient. Okay, so any questions? So I have a couple of questions here. One would be, when would we see respiratory acidosis occurring in our patients? So respiratory acidosis generally occurs when we've got hypoventilation in our patients. So that could be through a situation such as respiratory obstruction. Another one's asked for an advantage of intraosseous routes rather than the fact of access, and what we do get a rapid absorption of our fluids through the intraosseous route. So if we do need to get a rapid amount of fluids into these smaller patients and we can't get intravenous access, then we do get a rapid absorption with the intraosseous route. Okay, thank you.
A On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Donna for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.